That's right. We're right here this afternoon. Hey, I'm Ann Eller, and it is election time. And this afternoon, we have a candidate sitting in front of me. Her name is Barbara Jo Mullis. She is a Democratic candidate in the 3rd District, which means she's running against Jeff Duncan. So, how you doing today, Barbara?
I'm doing just fine.
That's great. Now, you have quite a background. I was reading your younger background. You played basketball. You also played baritone sax.
I came from a very small high school, and since there were so few of us, we got to do everything. So I got to be a guard on the basketball court back before there were Rovers.
Wow.
And I couldn't afford an instrument of my own, and so I had to borrow a school instrument. Baritone sax was the one that was available.
So how'd you do with that baritone sax?
It was a marching band, so that it was...
That was tough then, wasn't it?
It was sort of peculiar, but I managed.
You managed. That's great. Well, you know, I think those type of experiences, they give us so much to put forth life, you know, in the world. And, you know, it makes you realize that you really can tackle anything, don't you think?
I agree. You need to look at every single opportunity as a chance to find out more about yourself.
Exactly. Now, when you were growing up, what did you want to be?
Well, my father wanted me to be a pharmacist.
A pharmacist, okay.
Because he said, well, you know, you're smart and you like science, and pharmacists work in a nice environment. And I thought my dad was a pretty smart fella, so I went off to college to be pre-med. Mm-hmm. And about my sophomore year, I figured out that it was my father that wanted to be the pharmacist and not me. So I changed my major to anthropology.
Ooh, now there's a lot of things you can do with that major.
I'd like for you to name one. With a bachelor's degree in anthropology, you can't do anything except go back to school.
Wow.
And I was ready for work. So
what did you do?
So it was fortunate for me that it was 1970. Public Law 94-142, which is the legislation that started to serve special ed children, was being implemented that year, and there was a shortage of teachers in special ed.
Now, where did you grow up? Where was this at?
I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, in an area that's now become quite familiar to people because that's where the sniper is.
Wow. Okay. They say they're going to be a lot easier to find him now that the leaves are falling off.
Yeah, the pictures that you saw on television of how dense the woods are and how thick the brush is are typical of where I grew up. It'd be really easy to hide there.
Wow. So you grew up there, and so how did you get a job in teaching then from anthropology?
I was offered the job because I had done volunteer work through my sorority at a place called Selins Grove State Hospital. And because this was prior to 94-142, this was where children were warehoused who had handicapping conditions. And my sorority had adopted a children's ward at the state hospital, and I had done volunteer work throughout my college career. Mm. And the superintendent of schools considered that experience.
Okay. So that's how you got a job in special ed.
In special ed.
Now explain to us how you got from Pennsylvania down here to South Carolina.
In 1974, Metropolitan Life built a computer processing center behind what is now the Michelin World headquarters in Greenville. Mm-hmm. That building is no longer there, but my husband at the time was riding the dental trail. So we were shipped from Pennsylvania to South Carolina by Metropolitan Life.
Oh, wow. Was it a good move? Did you like coming to South Carolina?
It was a wonderful move. I was ready to try something new. I was ready to have a house and start a family. I continued my career, and I just felt good about Greenville at that time. It was before Greenville really started to grow.
To boom, yeah.
And I'm so thankful that I got to learn Greenville before now.
Right.
Because I don't know that I would be able to find my way around the way it is today.
It's really but, boomed. I mean, when you look at BMW and the tires and all these things, it's just huge. And then take Simpsonville and ZF Transmissions and all the things that are there. It's just...
Yeah, the CUI car has been a real incubator for all sorts of jobs and industry in that area.
Absolutely. So you kept teaching?
I continued to teach. I did take a year and a half off when I had my daughter. Mm-hmm. And then I went back part-time. I did job sharing before job sharing was a real thing.
Right.
Because I had a neighbor who had also just had a baby and was a special ed teacher. So we split the day at Simpsonville Elementary School, and she did the morning shift, and I did the afternoon shift, and that was one job.
Wow. How about that? That was a good setup, I would think.
That was wonderful. It worked out for both of us.
Yeah, that's great. So what do you think about this is going off a little off track here, but what do you think about special education today, what we're doing, how we're progressing on that?
I think that there are still some issues with access. I've talked to people as I've been going around campaigning, and I've had parents say, what can we do about getting services for our children? Mm-hmm. And some of the problem is expense. The school districts are hesitant to offer the services because services for special children can be very expensive. But then the parents are frustrated because their kids aren't having their needs met. And there is federal money for that. IDEA money is supposed to help cover those expenses, but there's still a gap between what we have and what we need.
Mm-hmm. And do you think as far as education that we are able to handle, to be able to, what shall we say, turn out citizens in that have special education, then that can be part of the community and everything. Do you think we're addressing those issues?
I think that most districts are. There are work-study programs. There are sheltered workshop programs. There's a wonderful one in Seneca that I'm familiar with because I also taught in Seneca. But not every community has those things set up. So again, there's a gap between what we need and what we have.
Yeah, what we have. Sure. Now, you didn't just stay in special education. This is what fascinates me. I think somewhere along the way you went on and you retired. Let's see, before you retired, you were honored and selected Wade Hampton High School Teacher of the Year.
Yes.
You started out with the lower grades and they kept moving you up, huh?
I lived in Charleston for 2 years, mm-hmm. and the state had then, and still has, a program for critical needs teachers. Special ed, science, and math are the critical need areas. And so they have money set aside to offer tuition deferral for teachers in those areas. And I had taken all of the special education courses that were being offered. And so I asked at the district office if I could take some of the science classes in the summer instead mm-hmm. of some of the special ed classes. And I got to take an environmental class at the Citadel and a physics class at the College of Charleston. And drawing on my prior background in pre-med, I had the credits and the scores and all of those things to add chemistry to my teaching credential. So when I moved back to the upstate, I didn't apply for special ed jobs. I applied for science teaching jobs.
Sure, exactly.
But that was back in 84.
84. But then you went on somewhere along the way, you decided to become retired. That didn't last very long, though, Barbara Jo.
No, this will be my third retirement.
Your third retirement?
I had put all of the time in for South Carolina, for full retirement in South Carolina. And in the meantime, I had married a fellow who was born in North Carolina, but who had come from the desert Southwest. Okay. He had lived in both New Mexico and Arizona. And so after we married, I said, I'm really not ready to retire. I'm not ready for just reading books on the boat kind of thing. So I went back to work.
And you went in New Mexico?
In New Mexico. Yes, yeah. New Mexico. His kids are in Arizona, but I got a job offer in Los Alamos that for a science teacher couldn't turn it down.
No, that's great. That's excellent. That's excellent. So here you are. You've now you've retired from teaching again, I guess. Yes?
Yes. I retired a year ago June.
A year ago June. All right. When we come back, we're going to find out what made her decide to run for office. Now, you've never held any other political office, have you?
No.
No.
But I've been a public servant for 41 years.
As a teacher.
Yes.
As a teacher. I understand. Okay. Well, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk about why she's running, what she thinks she can do, and how she attacks some of these issues. She's got a whole sheet here. We're going to try to go through them. So don't you go away.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
All right. Well, we're here with Barbara Jo Mullis. She is running for the U.S. House of Representatives from South Carolina's 3rd District. Those of you that are in the district know that right now Jeff Duncan is the man representing the 3rd District, and Greenwood is part of that district. Barbara Jo is a Democrat, and she needs to tell me and all of us why. Why, when you've had this wonderful life going on, why would you want to put yourself in the morass of Washington, D.C.?
First of all, I've always heard that if you complain about something, you should be willing to do something about it.
Do you complain?
I was complaining very, very loudly. And I started to look into what was happening in politics. Mm-hmm. And I had just, I really had been paying attention to politics, but not involved. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that there were a lot of places in South Carolina where the incumbent was not even going to be challenged. And that I lived in the 3rd District where, at the time, there was no one to run against Jeff Duncan. And I waited a little while, and I held off, and I asked a lot of people if there was any, you know, if there were any murmurings in the bushes that someone might be showing some interest in running. And it wasn't happening, and it was getting to the point where someone was going to have to start to develop committees and grassroots. So I said I'd do it.
Wow, that's impressive. I would, you know, that's taking a big step, Barbara Jo. I mean, you know, from retired teacher to U.S. Congressperson. That's a big step.
It didn't feel like that momentous of a decision. It felt like something that I had to do.
Of course, one of the things that is in this today's world, though, it takes so much money to run in politics.
Oh, well, if you've looked at the FEC report, you can see that I don't have so much money. I finished my filing for the 15th a little bit early and got it all squared away. But I have received some donations from the different county Democratic clubs, but candidates don't get big money from the Democratic campaign committee.
Right.
That
so you have to rely on people that believe in your campaign.
You have to rely on people, and so I started back before the primary, making contacts in the other counties of the district, and just letting folks know the kinds of things that I felt were amiss, and getting some feedback on what other folks felt that they needed to see happen or wanted to see happen so I could develop a platform. And it grew a life of its own.
Grew a life of its own, kind of like Washington, D.C. I think Washington, D.C. has a life of its own. I think, I don't know, you know, Mike Huckabee. I enjoy watching his show every once in a while. And he said that he thought what ought to happen is they need to move Washington, D.C. to some place like maybe Nashville and start over. And, you know, when you really think about it, that's not a bad idea because there is so much building and bureaucracy and everything growing there. It's hard to pull back to the things that are really important and get people to start working together.
I agree that the national government has a mind of its own, and it sort of feeds off of itself because all of the people in Washington say what they think each other wants to hear. Now, I've not been a politician, and people say, well, you know, it'll take about 5 minutes for you to turn into one.
Why do they say that?
Well, because they've seen what happens when people go to Washington and they say, oh, well, they're not going to be able to buy me off, or I'm still going to stick up for the little fellow. And then they start to see the money go by, and they start to see the privileges go by. And I'm not looking for a career in Washington. I've had my career and then some. So, you know, one or two terms, and I think that... I'll be ready to actually retire for the last time.
But how do you know you might not get up there and get influenced by the money and staying on? Because, you know, the longer you stay on, the better the retirement out of the federal government. I mean, you know, there's some perks there, Barbara Jo.
There are perks, but I'm really stubborn.
You're really stubborn? Okay. All right. But what do you think? Okay, you've got a whole platform here, and we're going to go through parts of it after we come back from the news. But to you, what do you see as the most important thing that you are going to Washington to take care of, to work with, to do? What do you see as the most glaring thing that needs to be fixed?
It's obvious to me that it's the economy. And I think that the key to fixing the economy is raising the minimum wage.
Oh, there's a tough topic right there. Why wouldn't we let employers, employment, do that? It's very difficult for a lot of people to even hire people at $7.25. Yes, it's there, but it's very hard to hire people at the minimum wage now.
I think that if the employers are the people who are reaping the benefits of their employees' work, that the employers should be at least paying a living wage.
But shouldn't the free market take care of that?
I don't think it does. If we were altruistic, yes, that would be what would happen. But the profit motive takes over those other higher ideals. And that is not what happens. People start to put profits and shareholders and those kinds of things ahead of the workers who are actually putting in their 40 hours.
Do you know of a lot of people that are working at minimum wage?
A lot of the younger women that I have met while I've been campaigning are working at minimum wage. A lot of the, I would say, 30-somethings young men that I have met while I've been campaigning are working for minimum wage.
In what type of jobs? Food service?
Well, the most of the young women that I've spoken to are working in food service. They're working as waitresses or other service-type industries, LPN, office clerk, or department store clerks. The young men are quite often doing physical labor. They're doing landscaping for somebody else, and they're thinking about, you know, starting their own landscaping company or those types of things.
Okay. We're going to have to hold it right there, but this is going to be an interesting conversation. Are you ready? Do you have a question? Give us a call. 229-7984. I'm Ann Eller. I'm here with Barbara Jo Mullis. Don't you go away.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help. from McDonald's McCafé cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafé mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. I'm right back here. I'm Ann Eller. I am here with Barbara Jo Mullis. She is a Democrat running for the U.S. House of Representatives from South Carolina's 3rd District, which is Jeff Duncan. So, Barbara, we were talking a little bit about the wage, the issues with the wage. Now, of course, there's been all kinds of things going on in the news. We've had some of the fast food workers protesting for $15 an hour wage, right?
Well, yeah. that's in Chicago and New York City.
Sure, but I mean, they have some areas of the country on the West Coast. They have they have set up a wage. I think it was up to $15 an hour, and it's phased in over 2 or 3 years. And I have no problem with paying a fair wage for somebody that is capable of doing a job, but to say that we have to go to $10.10 an hour to be fair, I'm not sure that it's fair to the employer. Is it fair that a high school student that has had no experience should be able to start at that rate?
I'll bring up the fact that I was a high school student who started at minimum wage when the minimum wage was $1.15 an hour. Everything else has gone up at least tenfold since that time.
Mm-hmm.
Gas was 29 cents a gallon. I know some of you folks aren't even going to believe that. But the minimum wage has not kept up. So you can't have the $1.15 an hour mindset. The minimum wage should be $10.10 an hour. Now, if you have value added, if you have had training and experience, you should make more than that.
Sure, absolutely. But I'm just saying to start young people at that rate that have had no experience, you think that's where everybody should be?
Babysitters are making that.
Yeah, but that's based on what? A free market? Isn't it based on free market? The person is willing to pay the person that wage.
True,
exactly. They're not being told that babysitters have to make $10.10 an hour. They're just being told that the babysitter is saying, I want $10 an hour. Let's use $10 because that's even, because I'm a good babysitter and I can command that rate. Correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And then they charge extra if you have more than one child to sit for.
Sure. But the babysitter is setting the rate that she is willing to work for. And we have a willing economy, a willing parents that know that this babysitter won't have her boyfriend over and she won't be partying and she'll be watching the children. So let's say they're willing to pay that.
But someone who's making minimum wage can't afford a babysitter.
Okay. So we should just up the wage to make it equal. Is that what
you're
saying?
Everybody's not going to make the same wage because, like I said, value added. If you've been to school, if you have a certificate, a degree, you're going to be worth more to your employer. I'm saying that the employer should be responsible for the minimum wage because right now someone working full-time minimum wage does not make a living wage. And then the taxpayers have to step in and provide housing supplements or food stamp supplements or WIC or CHIP or whatever other alphabet soup you want to call up. And I don't think that it's the taxpayer's job to cover the value of an employee.
So we should put it on the employers. We should give a
law. The employer is getting the benefit, so the employer should be paying the wage.
Okay. All right. I'm going to leave that one alone because this is one that we're never going to see eye to eye on. I can tell. Being an employer and being in this business for over 30 years and seeing how the free market works, I personally believe that the free market is a much better way to work. I believe that you should not have to pay high school students who are getting their first job and you're doing the training of them that much money just for them to learn how to do the job. And a lot of people that start out in a training wage do not stay at that job. They may stay at that rate to learn the job, but they do move up if they're motivated and want to move up.
I agree. There are also studies that have shown that the employees tend to stay with an employer, and so you don't get into the retraining cycle if you're paid a living wage.
Okay. But let's say I started somebody at $7.25 and I trained them and they became valuable to me. I am going to pay them more. I mean, that's the free market. The free market says, now you're more valuable. I don't want to have to train somebody else. So I am going to pay you more, and I will pay you more, and I will include this, and I will do that, because I don't want you going anywhere else. That's what I'm talking about in the free market.
Okay.
From that standpoint. Okay. Moving on here. What else are we going to talk about here? Oh, I got one more. Okay. All right. Here we go. James Marks just called. Okay, James Marks, can anybody tell him if anybody pays minimum wage for even food service? His busboy start at $8.50 an hour and go to $9.15 after 6 months. Mexican lawn service get at least $10 an hour. So that's from somebody that is, again, using the free market, using because he's training his employees, he's keeping them, he wants to keep good people, so he pays them more.
And I would congratulate him. I think that if we had more employers with that mindset, the minimum wage issue would not be an issue.
And I think it shouldn't be an issue, because I think that if we really look out there, I don't know of that many people that are actually, for any period of time, even if they are hired at minimum wage. Most employers feel, as this James Marks feels, that at $8.50 an hour, that's his starting wage. That's his learning wage. So he's not starting them even at $7.25. I don't know of many businesses that actually are at $7.25 an hour.
Again, I agree that he is a good employer.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of retaining employees by giving them raises, mm-hmm, is age old.
Sure.
But the other thing that minimum wage will do will be to increase traffic into his business. If you put the money in the pockets of people who are making minimum wage, they are going to increase the traffic in your door. So they are going to increase your business. It's like payback.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think we're a little far apart on that issue, and hey, that's okay. That's what this is all about. That's what it's all about, is trying to get to the bottom level and try to make decisions on what works. I personally believe in free market. I think free market sets the price that people will work at, and people don't have to work at that price, and if employers can't find people at that rate, then of course they have to up the rate in order to keep employees. And after an employer maybe has hired half a dozen people at minimum wage and they don't stay and they don't work out and they're not qualified, then he or she makes that decision to move it up to another level. So that's where the free market and my philosophy comes. Okay, but moving on. We've got more here, folks. This is just the beginning. Okay. All right, we got another explosive issue here that I know that everybody's going to jump on. Okay. The NRA, Second Amendment. What's your feeling about the Second Amendment and gun control or lack thereof?
I think that as things stand today, it has gotten out of hand.
Okay.
I am not a hunter myself. I tried to learn to shoot once and discovered that I was not very good at it.
Okay.
I don't want to take people's guns away from them.
Okay.
I love venison stew.
Okay. Somebody's got to shoot it.
Somebody has to shoot it. But you don't shoot it with an AR-15. So I just feel like things have gotten a little out of hand.
What would be your solution?
I think that we should start with background checks.
Okay, we have a basic background check.
But it doesn't extend to gun shows or one-on-one sales.
Okay.
And I think that
that would be kind of difficult to do one-on-one sales.
They've got a website set up.
Do they? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So those that could it could be done technology-wise, and I think that it would stop some people who shouldn't have guns from falling through the cracks. Someone who has an domestic abuse charge against him, someone who has a documented mental illness. There are some people that just don't need guns.
Correct. So how would you handle that? Should I be able to have a concealed weapons permit and carry a gun because it makes me feel safe?
If you have been trained,
mm-hmm. you have to have that to get a concealed weapons
and
permit.
And you have a permit or a license to carry that gun.
Mm-hmm.
You could have one in your purse right now and I wouldn't know it.
Okay.
But if you're brandishing a gun in public,
mm-hmm.
that makes me feel less safe.
Okay. But if so where do you draw the where are you wanting to draw the line? I know that you talk about in your brief here about the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, and that you says you have no problem with the current active members of the military guard owning arms that use to fulfill their duties. You have no problem with hunters, but exempting the National Guard and hunting for food, it's time for reasonable gun control measures. So where do you draw the line? Because we have a lot of people that are not in the National Guard, are not hunters, and they love their guns. I know plenty of people that collect guns. I know plenty of people that have gun safes full of guns.
I have a son-in-law and a stepson who are gun aficionados. They have one of each.
They
love their guns, and they love to go shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But they are extremely safe about handling their guns. They are always either in a safe or trigger locked. They are not accessible to children in the home. They are handled properly. They're handled respectfully. And we have some cowboys out there who are not doing that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have so many gun accidents. You know, there's one in the news every other day.
Sure, yes. So you're saying that then who should not have guns?
I think anyone with a felony conviction for a violent crime,
mm-hmm.
And especially, like I mentioned earlier, domestic abuse, because in South Carolina that's just rampant, and we know that a gun ups the chance that that woman is at some point going to be shot,
or that woman could shoot him because she's tired of dealing with him.
She could.
Yeah.
That would be what he might deserve.
Right. Okay. So that would be okay. See. All right.
But that also is not what I would call responsible gun ownership.
Sure.
but I do think that we could at least start with background checks. And, you know, after we get over the fear of having background checks, have a reasonable conversation about what was the intent of our founding fathers and what do we have today. Because I don't think that the founding fathers thought people were going to be going into Kroger with a gun strapped over their shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I understand. Okay. Well, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. We're going to readjust here. We'll be back. You got a question or a comment you want to make, give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here. We are talking with Barber Joe Mullis here this afternoon. She is the Democratic candidate for the 3rd District, Congressional 3rd District, which she is running against, I guess we'd have to say, Jeff Duncan. So let's talk a little bit about education.
Right up my alley.
I figured it might be. What is your feeling? Big conversations about school vouchers, school choice. What is your feeling, Barbara?
I am not for vouchers.
You're not for vouchers.
I am not for vouchers. They take money out of the public schools, and they make it more difficult for the schools then to offer programs that help children stay in school. We've had schools that have dropped art and music and PE because they can't fund those related arts. And a voucher program or a choice program is different from a magnet school program.
Mm-hmm.
The magnet school programs are part of the public school. If a high school offers or a district offers IB, International Baccalaureate, at one of their high schools, that is still part of the public school system.
Now, what about online? What about for online schooling?
I don't think most people realize how difficult online schooling is.
It is difficult. I've had to take some of those classes.
The self-discipline that it takes as an adult to do an online class is Herculean.
Well, what about the fact that our children learn at all different rates and all different types? And quite often parents find that the public school is not addressing the things that their children need.
I taught for 41 years. Diversity was one of the first things I looked at when I planned my lessons and my curriculum.
So, well, you might be the exception, Barbara.
I was a good teacher, but
okay,
I don't think that I am an exception to the rule, because I worked in science departments and I worked in teaching teams, and I felt like everybody on the team was on the same page in terms of meeting the needs of the variety of students that would come in the door.
So you believe that a public education should be able to serve the majority of the students?
Correct.
And that school vouchers is not something we should get into. If somebody wants to send their child to private school or to a different alternate type school system or wants to homeschool them, then they should just pay for it themselves.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. And what do you think about the fact that as public schools, one of the arguments against this is as public schools just get the money, that they don't live up to the standards that maybe if a student was marching with their feet to come to your school or not to come to your school, that school vouchers would do. We have a lot of substandard schools, too.
I realize that there are, in South Carolina, they don't call it the corridor of shame for nothing.
Right.
Fortunately, that is not in the 3rd District, but and this is not a congressional answer,
right?
But the funding to the public schools from our state government mm-hmm. has been cut, and so the state is not giving to the individual school districts what it is supposed to be giving according to the funding formula.
Okay.
So some of that is a more local issue.
Now, what about, because this is kind of related to this, Common Core and the role of the federal government, shall we say, in controlling the school districts or controlling state education. Should local school districts, is schooling a state issue or is it a federal issue?
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, it is both issues. It is both.
It's a state and a federal issue?
It is a state issue and it is a federal issue. The Common Core was originally developed out of the governor's committee. All 50 governors got together and decided that we needed some uniformity. In this century, with the differences between the states and the fact that our population is so mobile, that we needed to have some uniformity in standards.
This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. We're going to hold this over a few minutes, but I just needed to say that. Go ahead.
Okay. However, curriculum is not the same thing as standards. Curriculum is how the teacher decides to present that skill to the students. It is the kind of reinforcement that the teacher gives to the students as they are learning that skill. Mm-hmm. Curriculum happens at the local level.
Okay.
It may happen at the district level. It may happen at the school department level, at least in a high school where you have, you know, the science department and the English department. And it happens as locally as an individual teacher's desk. When you get a good idea for a lesson plan, you're going to develop that plan, teach it in your class, and then share it with your colleagues. That's what we call best practices.
Sure.
So the implementation is local. The standard, which is what you should be able to do, is a national standard.
Okay. Now, what about the dollars and the control from the federal government? As far as you will get dollars if you do this. You will not get dollars if you do not. I mean, this is an age-old thing with the federal government. What do you feel about that, Barbara?
In South Carolina, one out of every 7 per pupil dollars comes from the federal government.
Okay,
that comes to us from the federal government regardless. The incentives are actually something that I am not in favor of. The incentives were part of No Child Left Behind, mm-hmm. which is way past its expiration date. Mm-hmm. And they were incentives to have school districts try new stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they got waivers to be allowed to try new stuff, and then they got money to implement the new stuff. And it hasn't worked.
Correct.
So that piece of federal interference in local education, I really disagree with.
Okay. Do you think we need a Bureau of Federal of Education?
I think we do.
You do. Okay.
The education is so complex and the country is so complex that if there is not some overriding system that you can compare apples to apples and not compare Utah to Kansas or to South Carolina. In terms of saying these kids got a good education and these kids didn't. So I do think there needs to be an overarching system.
Do you think that we need the federal government to be able to, are you for big federal government?
I'm for the government to be big enough to do its job well.
Okay, where is our government at right now, Barbara Jo? Almost $18 trillion in debt, but well, let's not talk about that. But where is our government at right now?
There are pieces of the government that are way too big. And there are pieces of the government that have been cut and need to be refinanced. Right now, everybody's worried about the Ebola scare.
Mm-hmm.
But public health was one of the things that was really chopped up in the sequester. And the Senate is withholding confirmation of a Surgeon General, so there is no Ebola czar.
Well, we can always add a czar. That's real easy. President Obama just goes in and says, you're it. So for a czar here.
Well, I think that we need someone above the level of an Ebola czar.
Okay. All right. I agree with you, but I mean, as far as putting an Ebola czar in there. But my real concern is the size of our government just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it doesn't seem to understand that maybe it's overreaching what it was originally intended for. I mean, wasn't our Constitution very specific on what our government was supposed to do?
If we only did what the Constitution says,
yes,
we wouldn't even need the Bill of Rights.
Well, no, that's not exactly true. You need the Bill of Rights here now, Barbara. Come on now.
We do need, need the Bill of Rights.
Right.
Because the Constitution is not the end-all and be-all of...
A lot of people say that the Constitution isn't even necessary in today's world. And the government certainly is doing a whole lot more than it ever was intended to perform.
The Founding Fathers intended for our Constitution, though, to be a living document. They could not.
It was supposed to be able to change?
That's what amendments are for.
Right, amendments are, right.
So, and that's a very difficult process on purpose.
Exactly.
But our founding fathers could not anticipate drones and the internet and vaccines even.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to run out of time, and we do have a couple more questions here, Barbara, so I'm going to leave it with that one. Two questions. Number one, do you favor building the pipeline?
I am not in favor of building the Keystone XL pipeline.
And why is that, Barbara?
There would be some jobs generated building the pipeline. But once the pipeline is built, there would only be 30 jobs left to maintain the pipeline, number one. So jobs is not a good argument. Number two, it's not going to contribute to energy independence, because the reason they want to send that oil to the Gulf is to refine it and put it on tankers and sell it to China or whoever else wants to buy the refined oil. And the third thing is, it's too dangerous.
It's too dangerous?
It's too dangerous.
We already have pipelines growing underground there that are smaller.
That are smaller.
Right. And, I mean, an 8-inch pipe versus a 12-inch pipe or whatever it is.
And they spill regularly.
Mm.
And if there were a breach that ever got into the Ogallala Aquifer, that would contaminate the water supply for a half a dozen whole states. There are dangerous chemicals. It's designed to carry car sands, tar sands. It's not designed to carry petroleum. We tend to think of petroleum as a very gooey liquid, mm-hmm. but tar sands are rough. It's like liquid sandpaper. And so the chance of a spill is much higher in a pipeline carrying tar sands because of the abrasive nature of what's flowing through the pipe.
So you would tell Canada, go ahead and sell it to China, send it to China?
They can't send it raw to China. They have to refine it before they can send it to China. And they Canada tried to get a pipeline to the Pacific Northwest, to Vancouver, mm-hmm. and their own Canadian people didn't want it, which is why they tried to talk the Americans into it.
All right. Now, when you talk about energy, though, what is your feeling about fossil fuels, drilling off the coast of South Carolina? How do you feel about all those?
I think that it's time to stop spending a lot of taxpayer money to support fossil fuels. We started that 100 years ago, and...
But we're finding that we have more and more, Barbara.
But we need to use our brains and go to alternative energy while we are still in the position of choosing to transition before we get desperate. Now, in South Carolina, if South Carolina were to go haul hog into wind energy, mm-hmm. offshore wind, because we do not have onshore wind that blows strong enough for a wind farm. If South Carolina harnessed half of the offshore wind that's available, it would fuel the entire state every hour of every day forever.
Okay.
The offshore gas reserves that my opponent keeps touting are 3.5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas.
Okay.
3.5 trillion sounds like a really big number.
Yeah.
If we tapped that today, it would be all used up 7 weeks from now. It would be gone. There wouldn't be any more left. It represents 0.18% of the world's supply of natural gas. So it's a very small deposit.
Okay.
It is far enough offshore that it is in 80 meters of ocean. That's a half a mile deep.
Right.
And before there was the drilling moratorium, there was drilling off the South Carolina and Georgia coast. They drilled 7 test wells, and every single one came up dry. So if I were an executive of an oil company and I had only 0.18% of the supply and I had to go down a half a mile deep before I hit bedrock, mm-hmm. and I knew that there were already 7 dry wells, I don't think that I would make that investment.
Okay. All right. So you believe in using wind power?
For South Carolina, wind is the best option.
Okay.
For personal use, like rooftop use, there's certainly nothing wrong with solar, but wind is alternating current, for those of you who are electronic out there. And solar is direct current.
Okay.
There are issues with direct current. It doesn't travel very well, so you have to have it close. And you either need to get all new appliances or you need to have an inverter that converts it from direct current to alternating current. Wind is generated on the spot. In that nacelle at the top of the blades is where the generator is. It doesn't have to be mined or burned, or it's generated by the wind.
I guess you're not for fracking either.
I am not for fracking.
I figured you might not be. All right, I'm here with Barbara Jo Mullis. I got another question for you. We are running over here a little bit, but this is fun. This is interesting. What do you feel about, do you have a comprehensive immigration policy, and what translates, which translates to amnesty?
Okay, well, I believe amnesty is probably in the ear of the beholder. I do support the Dreamers, the young folks who have been brought here, have been here for 5 years, and are either going to college to get a degree or are going into the service for this country, that citizenship for Dreamers is a good plan. The next step that I think President Obama is about to take, although I'm not in his head, so I can't guarantee that, is to extend the same option to the parents of Dreamers. We cannot send 11 million people back. Just rounding them up and sending them back would be a monumental task.
But they're here illegally, so we should just grant them all amnesty?
No, I don't think that we should grant them all amnesty. And we need to filter through, certainly don't need felons, drug dealers, those.
What about all the children that came across here this last summer, across the Texas border, just pouring into our country?
Those children, I believe, to a large extent, were refugees. They should be treated the same way the Cuban refugees are treated.
What about all the things they came out that they knew that if they came to this country, they would be able to just walk right in, that that some of them were even being paid, that parents were paying to send their children across the border and everything? Why shouldn't we have a border that is non-porous? Why shouldn't we protect our borders?
We have a very good border patrol, but
they're not able to do their job.
Well, they do catch a lot of, they catch a lot of illegal aliens. A lot of illegal aliens die trying to cross the desert in Arizona and New Mexico.
Not in their relationship to the number that have come across, Barbara Jo.
But the children who were crossing into Texas were crossing out in the open because they thought that they would have asylum from the violence and the killings and the things that they were doing to children in their home countries.
Do you believe that's all totally true? That all these children that came across were all abused, damaged children that were coming across our border?
There probably should be a filter, an interview process, a validation process.
They are interviewed. And then because they're children, we promise them an education because they're here. They're supposed to go for a hearing. They never go back for the hearing. They end up in all these communities. And our tax dollars are paying for these kids to have that education because every child in the United States is promised an education.
We're a lot better off with literate refugee children than illiterate refugee
children. What about the cost? What about the cost to the communities? The cost of, maybe they don't speak English. Maybe they're not on the same grade level. Even though they're 12, they're not 12-year-old ready.
Well, they do. very few of them are actually speaking English. They are English language
so we have
learners.
We have to have somebody else that can interpret and teach them English. I mean, we spend a lot of money. Is it really our responsibility when we have people in our own country that are our own people that we're not taking care of?
I think we should take care of both of them.
Why should we take care of people that are not of our origin, that are not of our country? Other countries don't take other people in and say, "Oh, sure, come on in."
But they do. In the Mideast, there are hundreds of Iraqi refugees who are now living in Turkey.
Yes, because that is a desperate situation, but I don't see that in Mexico or Colombia or some of these areas that we have children coming up from, that it is the same as that situation.
For those children, it's a desperate situation. If they're living on the street, if they're afraid...
Living on the street, I bet they can't get themselves from living on the street to cross that border unless somebody is paying and somebody is taking them up that way, because that's a heck of a long trip.
It is a terrible long trip.
Exactly.
And I don't know how those trips are financed.
Exactly. And that is part of the problem. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to tell me why you should be the next congresswoman from the 3rd District going up there and straighten them out in Washington, D.C.
I would like to get your vote on November 4th or earlier if you want to vote absentee. And I would like to get your vote because I'm going to put the citizens of the 3rd District first. I think for too long that we have put the wealthy and the people who are the lobbyists and the people who are paying for campaigns first, and I have a grassroots campaign, and so I have no other axe to grind. The people of the 3rd District come first to me.
Is that all you would like to say, my dear? That's it.
Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for listening.
All right. Hey, Barbara Jo Mullis, she is running for the 3rd District here. She is on the ballot, and she is running against Jeff Duncan. So make sure you find out more about her. Do you have a website?
I do. It's www.barbarajoforcongress.us. And I also have a Facebook page, Barbara Jo for Congress.
Okay. Check it out. Sign up. See what she's all about. Any places you're going to be up in this area, Barbara Jo?
Tomorrow there is a debate, not a debate, it's a candidate forum at Tri-County Tech in Pendleton. It starts at 1:15 in Oconee Hall.
Okay.
And it's being sponsored by the League of Women Voters. Jeff Duncan won't be there. He hasn't agreed to debate me yet.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Thanks you so much, Barbara Jo Mullis. This is WCRS. Bye-bye, everybody.